Why are they doing this? They said when you got here, the whole thing started. I think you're the cause of all this. I think you're evil. Evil!
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Monsters, John. Monsters from the It.
Swallow this.
The power of Christ compels you! The power of Christ compels you!
Have you ever heard of Candyman?
You moved the cemetery, but you left the bodies, didn't you?
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
You don't know what death is.
This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation.
I'm the messenger of God. You're doomed. We can stay here.
God is dead!
Satan lives!
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
The animals are contagious! What fire! Stop! You've no idea!
You're not afraid of the dark, are you?
Whatever you do, don't fall asleep.
It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Secretary, the missiles are flying. Hallelujah.
You'll see me in hell, Mr. Thorne. There will be a shout of sentence.
I can't lie to you about your choices, but you have my sympathies.
This little procedure is called making a head of a mistake.
I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains.
There is no one watching out for us, Meryl. We are all on our own.
And there's no more room in hell than the dead who walk here.
The events of that day were to lead to the discovery of one of the most bizarre crimes in the annals of American history, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes.
Something in the mill! Shut the door, my God! You gotta tell them! Silent Breed is people!
You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over!
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, my friend?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
This is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
I'm here. How are you, Phil?
All right. I'm doing well. And in the state of Massachusetts?
It's Abe.
Hey, Abe.
Hey, guys.
How are you doing?
I'm all right. A little tired. Just started college this week.
Oh yeah. What is this?
Well, he's all grown up.
What is it? Junior now or something like that? Or
well, by credits, yeah. It's I'm a junior still. This is my second semester at my college at UMass Lowell.
Very good. And hey, by the way, you do a genre blog?
Yeah. It's called A Real Movie Reviewer. You can find it by going to your basic search engine. If you need help spelling Reeler, it's spelled R-E-E-L-E-R, We Reviewer. Or you can go into the Dark Discussions main page and look to your right-hand side, and you'll find links to it as well as to other blogs and sites that
you
can enjoy.
That's true. And one of the blogs, Mike, you do one too?
Yes, that's Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com, found on the internet near you.
And Eric, you do a podcast, another podcast with your buddy Dan.
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. You will need help spelling that because we made up the word. It's Askancity. You can find it on Stitcher and in the iTunes store.
That's right. And here it's www.darkdiscussions.com. On the front page on the right side of that page is links to all those things that we just mentioned, as Abe said, and at the bottom of every page of www.darkdiscussions.com are links to iTunes, the RSS feed, Stitcher, Twitter, email, and the Facebook group, which is called Dark Discussions Podcast. And we are a genre podcast that basically discusses horror films, science fiction, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, exploitation, and whatever that is speculative.
But none of that mushy crap.
No. Unless it has science fiction or some sort of element in it. But
okay, yeah. there's mushy crap and some of that other stuff.
Yeah, well, actually, I was talking to someone once about the podcast, and they go, oh, since it could be speculative, so that could Mary Poppins, the film, could be considered? And I said, well, technically, I guess you're right. So
I wouldn't hold your breath waiting for that episode.
That's right. I don't think so. So let's see. First off, our Twitter feed, when we released the Horsehead episode and let folks know all about it, the director of Horsehead saw the tweet and he liked it. So that was kind of cool. I don't think he retweeted it, though.
That's all right.
Let's see what else. Well, Eric, first off, have you seen any films or read any books that you wanted to mention that folks may be interested in that is genre related?
I have been kind of stuck lately. I looked for help on the Facebook group and I got some great suggestions there, but I haven't had time to follow up on any of them. So I really haven't been watching a lot. I was a little bit burned out and having trouble finding material that I actually wanted to watch. So last weekend I watched Hercules with Dan, the new one starring The Rock. It's exactly what you think it is. So if that appeals to you, watch it. If it doesn't, don't. I also finished up Jack Reacher novel, Never Go Back, which is what the next Jack Reacher installment movie is going to be. Jack Reacher 2 is going to be based on that story, and I really don't understand why they're naming the movies Jack Reacher and Jack Reacher 2 and not going with the names of the novels, but oh well, I'm not a Hollywood executive. And other than that, I've been just busy with work.
And it's interesting, too. I could see them doing Jack Reacher, but maybe Jack Reacher colon.
And exactly. The yeah, that's the way I would do it personally, but what do I know?
Yeah, what are you going to do? Yeah. Let's see, what about you, Mike?
I did forget to mention, I think, was it 2 weeks ago that we did an episode? I did forget to mention I finally did see Maze Runner, and it was okay. It was still a lot built on, we're not allowed to tell you stuff because it would be inconvenient for the story. But it was an interesting film for the teen adventure genre.
The ending was awesome, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know, I kind of saw that. I've seen the trailers for the new film.
Yeah, that's coming out in a couple of weeks.
Right, so some of that was kind of, I guess, made it easier for me to suspect what's going to happen with what it was coming at the end of that film.
Ah.
I saw Wormwood finally.
Oh yeah. Hey, what do you think?
It's weird because it's like a 90-minute movie. It felt a little long for me because it's a very fast-paced movie and a lot of quick cutting. But it's like there's a moment where two storylines meet up at the end.
Yep.
Right. And it was by that point it started to feel like it got a little stretched out longer than it should have been. It's had some really weird ideas and weird things to do with the zombie genre. But, you know, if you're accepting that the dead are up and walking around, you know, there's no reason you can't assume that they're also able to power automobiles. You know, it's just, it's not a film that takes itself seriously, right? So you can take some of that silly stuff and just go, well, fuck it. It makes it for a fun film.
A top 10 film for the year, possibly, or even an episode?
I don't know, possibly. Right. And
it's an Australian film, by the way. Australian.
Yeah, certainly one I'd like to revisit. Two other films I watched, there was another one in the zombie, sort of, zombie subgenre, which is called Extinction, okay, with Matthew Fox from Lost.
Oh, yeah.
It's strange because it starts out with the zombie outbreak, right? And the people being, I don't want to say rounded up because it makes it sound too Kristallnacht, but, people sort of in retreat in the face of the zombie apocalypse. And of course shit happens. And then we cut to 7 or 8 years later and basically you're left with, what, for all we know, are two of the last men on Earth a young girl, it's one of their daughters, who was a baby infant at the beginning of the film, and what could be the last dog on Earth. And basically just those four living next to each other, because naturally if the entire world is destroyed, you're going to move next to the only person that you seem to can't stand. But it's been, it sort of focuses on their situation. It's a lot of family drama, and some people I know didn't like it. It was okay. The events, a lot of flashback as to what happened. It adds some new things sort of to the zombie genre, because it does, basically, once you jump forward, it's hard to call it a zombie film anymore. Because anything resembling the zombie that we're familiar with disappears after that first 10 minutes or so. But it was a fun film, and I found the last act pretty intense. But that was me. So I would recommend that one. And on a quieter side, there was a movie called, I think it's Closer to God. Okay. And it's basically a story of what happens when you make the first cloned human being. And so a doctor or a group of doctors make the first cloned human being, or supposedly make the first cloned human being, and how does society react or respond to it.
I saw a trailer for that.
And of course, because this is a horror film, or horror science fiction film, there is a deep, dark secret that sort of goes hand in hand, because there is another child.
And that's not much of a secret if you saw the trailer.
Yeah. And I don't know, I kind of liked it. Not necessarily a brilliant film, but I just kind of liked the way it played out. I think those are the main ones as far as anything new that I saw. And I would recommend checking out all of them. You know, I know obviously the people who are burnt out on zombies will be reluctant to look up Wormwood or Extinction, but I don't think either one is a typical zombie subgenre film. They're very different. One is, certainly Wormwood is much more zombie related, but again, different zombies. And Extinction, I'm trying not to spoil anything, really there isn't that much of what you would consider to be zombies again after the first few minutes. So it's more like, we need an apocalypse. Zombies? Sure! Then fast forward. there are other things that pop up in the film later, but again, spoilers.
Very good. Very good. Any of these films worth an episode, you think?
Possibly.
All right. Very good. Yeah, maybe I'll check them out. Where can you find them? On Netflix?
They are all available for instant streaming. Wormwood is on Netflix. I don't know about Closer to God or Extinction. If they're not out on Netflix yet, they're available to rent in your usual streaming services, and will probably be on Netflix sooner rather than later.
Now, Closer to God, I've heard mixed reviews on that one.
It's a slow burn film, and I can understand some people not liking it, as you would sort of expect with films, since a lot of it's built around the protests that pop up. So you can't necessarily say, and you're seeing things from the point of view mostly of the doctor and the people who are or the on the cloning side.
Yep.
So it may not paint the religious worshipers in the best light, although I didn't find how they did it to be all that much of a stretch. Because it is the sort of thing that you would see people protesting, you know, and anytime you get people protesting, well, they're upset, they're angry, and so they're not going to see them as, you know, their best selves. I don't necessarily take it as being, like necessarily attacking the anti-clone side, especially given how events eventually play out in the movie.
Very good. All right. Sounds good. Yeah, for me, I saw three films of interest. Two Blu-ray releases by Code Red. The first was a slasher from the 80s called Sweet 16, and another I guess, a slasher also from the 80s called Nail Gun Massacre. Both were a pretty good looking on Blu-ray, so if you want high definition of these slasher films, the Code Red releases are recommended. I actually enjoyed both of them. Neither of them are as memorable as some other slashes from that era, but they were both fun to watch. Nail Gun Massacre has been known by some folks to be a bad good movie, and you can see that because of it's very low budget, but all in all, worth checking out if you like slasher films or 80s horror. Though I do have to admit, neither are actually truly scary in a sense, and I've noticed that a lot with 80s films, that you have your scary ones like say Friday the 13th Part 1 and so forth, but then you have your thriller types, and I would call these two like the thriller types but are thrown into the horror because they're slashers. And then of course you get your what's the word I'm looking for, meta stuff that you see in the sequels of various franchises. So not scary horror, but horror by definition. I've also saw a film called Z for Zachariah. It's a science fiction film that is streaming now for rent. It stars, has a pretty damn good cast. It has Christopher Pine, the guy that was the lead in Star Trek films, as Kirk. Chiwetel Ejiofor, I know I'm screwing that name up, but he's a Nigerian, a British actor of Nigerian descent that was nominated for an Academy Award a couple of years ago. But the big star also in this film was Margot Robbie, probably the next big female actress out there. She was the lead in The Wolf of Wall Street, and she has a lead in this film now. And it's very slow drama.
I was going to say it looked like a drama from the trailer.
Yeah, it was really more a drama, and that's probably the reason why I rented it out of like six or five new releases that I could have picked. And I would call it similar to like The Road, but not as dark. So, in other words, it's a post-apocalyptic where there's only a handful of people, but unlike The Road, which is very melancholic, this is more straight drama of three people in the post-apocalyptic and what happens between them and this world and where they're trying to survive. High recommend. I thought it was really good. It's based off a book by Robert C. O'Brien. He's the author of The Rats of Nim. Folks may know that book, as well as the movie, the cartoon movie from about 20 years ago, and high recommend. I would recommend all you folks to see it, especially you, Mike, and you, Eric, because I know you guys can get into dramas pretty good. I'm not sure about you, Abe. What about you, Abe? What have you seen?
I haven't watched anything recently, but I have been delving into The Evil Within.
Oh, yeah, the video game.
Yeah.
Oh, good. I was worried there for a second.
And funny story about that, when I went into the store to get it, I found a casing with a $20 pricing label on it. And when I went up to buy it, the cashier was like, "Oh, where'd you find it? I've been looking for that cover all day." And I was like, "It was up there." And he was clearly confused. It's like, well, that's funny because today we jacked up the prices to their full like twice as much. So it was supposed to be like $40 as opposed to the $20 it was labeled. But what was cool though, he's just let it slide and just let me get it for $20 along with another game. So I got two games for the price of one that day.
Nice.
In terms of the game itself, it's an interesting one. Its presentation is really nice. I like its atmosphere. You're basically inside the mind of some kind of madman, and all of his dark thoughts and memories take manifested forms of monsters and shit. Gameplay wise, it can be really enjoyable, although I felt that the controls felt a little off at times. And some of the difficulty comes from some of the gimmicks that the game throws at you, like some booby traps, and certain enemies have certain ways they can one-shot you. But it's a fun game. I'm only like maybe a quarter of the way into it so far. And it might be end up being a bit of a slow burn now that I have studies to take care of as well on the side. But once I finish, I'll let you guys know how it is by the end.
Yeah, I have to pretty much agree with everything you said about it, because I do have a copy of it, and I played about a quarter, and I came to the boss behind the wall in the barn. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's fairly tough, so I put it down for about 2 months now, and I may go back and play it and pick it up from there, but it's a good game, but yeah, it's a step below, I think, the classic or any Silent Hill game for that matter. So, it's still good.
The Silent Hill games are definitely much bigger on their storytelling, but they do have at least a solid gameplay as well.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, it's a recommend, but keep your expectations in check. The main thing that makes it really good is the atmosphere and the things like that. I do like their safe room. That was kind of a pretty cool area.
Oh, yeah, because it was awesome about the safe room, as opposed to, like, in Resident Evil, where it's just a quiet room. The safe room itself screws with your mind a lot. It actually plays tricks on you.
That's right. Yep. Anything else, Abe?
Not on my end.
All right, now this is the part that Eric dreads. And anybody see the most recent episodes of The Strain or the new television show, Fear of the Living Dead, or Walking Dead.
Is Aaron now?
Fear of the Walking Dead. Two episodes have transpired so far, yes.
I actually watched the pilot for that.
Oh, okay. What did you think, Erica? Your opinion is probably the most important, because you aren't a big fan of the original series, nor am I, actually.
It was fine. I mean, I always I'm a sucker for an origin story. So I enjoyed it. But I don't know where it's going, really, because we already know what happens. So I'm unsure of the motivation behind the creation of this show, quite honestly.
Money!
But, well, yeah, money, but I don't understand why they feel the need to tell this story. Because unless they're going to give us more details on exactly what the heck happened, but I don't think they are. So it was fine for what it is, but, you know, it is what it is, so...
Yeah, I actually the second episode is much better. The second episode actually reminded me more of the first half hour of World War Z, the film World War Z. So episode two is really good. And as Mike knows, I'm a big fan of the zombie apocalypse as it's happening, not the post after.
Right.
The fact. And the second episode is really good for doing that. What about you, Mike? What's your opinion of the show? Have you been watching it?
I'm liking it so far. It's we didn't mention – didn't talk about it last week. I think the first episode probably played it a little too safe. I mentioned this. I think it was like clearly this is a show that knew it was in no risk of being pulled from the air. And so didn't seem to have the need to make sure – dragged viewers in. It's like we're Walking Dead, people are watch anyway, so they're kind of telling the story at their own pace. I think the second week was better. There is something nice that everybody's new, unlike the original, which, you know, having read the comics, I knew all the characters and had, or at least thought I had, a good idea as who was earmarked to live and die. This time around, like, for example, in the second episode, Reuben Blades plays a shopkeeper.
Yep.
Right? And I honestly don't know if he's, like, special guest star Reuben Blades or Reuben Blades, future long-term star of the TV series.
Yep.
Right? So I don't really know who's going to be around, because it's only a short, like, 6 or 8 episode season.
Yeah, it was curious too, Mike, because it's the student in episode two that appears that he's going to possibly be a long-term character, and then maybe he's not now. And same with the shopkeeper. It'll be curious to see if they go that route, or is he just, you know, in the next two episodes and that's it? I don't know.
And I would be interested to see if they would have the balls to introduce someone like that kid and never find out what happened to him.
Yeah,
because that's something that would happen. If there was a zombie apocalypse, the odds are there will be people that you would lose touch with, and yeah, you'd probably be pretty sure they died, but you would never know, right? You wouldn't necessarily. Oh my God, there's Charlie, and he's a zombie. He never made it home after all. You know, it's people would just disappear, and maybe they went off to be a group of survivors somewhere else. You know, or maybe they died in Resurrector. Or maybe they just died, you know, so who knows. So it'll be interesting to see if they do that with any of the characters at all, just have them just disappear amidst the chaos, which you could do at this point, you know, because you're not that attached to any of the characters, and people aren't going to go, but I have to know what happened to that character now.
Right. Well, it's going to be curious because the main thing there, it appears, is that it's going to be the family as the main group of characters. But the question is, will they just be a part of a survivor group, or will they be, you know, the only main characters, and then people just come in and out, as you discussed? And then they have another interesting thing, too, which is the ex-wife of the lead male is now a possible character, you know, for the long term. And if she goes along with him and their son, then there's going to be an odd triangle between him, his ex-wife, and his present wife.
How much would it suck to have to survive the zombie apocalypse with your ex-wife?
That would suck. Yeah,
would
and she was a excuse my French, but she was a bitch in the show. They made her be a really stinker because of her and I don't want you to come see my kid and blah blah blah. It's not your turn this weekend. And it's like, okay, so it's they're not happy. And since we've only know his side of the story, it makes her character look like she's, well, the B word. And that may
yeah,
not
and
be
it,
the case.
He could be an asshole too, for all we know. So, you know, it can't be any better for her to have to survive with her ex-husband.
Right. Yes, exactly. So yeah, that'll be curious. I mean, I'll say one thing. He's married again, while she's not, and it doesn't appear she has a boyfriend. So maybe that tells you something. I don't know. But yeah, so that'll be curious. I did not know it was a short season, Mike, but that doesn't surprise me because the first Walking Dead was that way as well, right? Season one.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the Walking Dead was a short season because they really had no idea. You know, AMC was still very much in its fledgling stages of TV,
TV shows,
and things like Mad Men and Breaking Bad had garnered critical acclaim, but hadn't garnered any viewership.
Right.
And Walking Dead is the one that got eyeballs there, and then they used those eyeballs to basically pay for the last couple seasons of Mad Men, which is why the budget was cut for season two.
Right.
And now you're at the point where they clearly know, like, Walking Dead is not going anywhere, and that you could see in the last season they spent a lot more money, or were willing to spend a lot more money in the show than they would have been in, say, the first or second season.
Right. So, all right, very well. So, and then, of course, the Strain is continuing, and I'm still enjoying that, so far. All right. Anything else before we go into our episode and the big news that surrounded the horror community in this episode? Any further news or updates or information folks wanted to mention about the genre that's in basically blogs, newspapers, whatever?
Just that Sinister 2 came out, and all of us were too afraid to go see it. Because it's getting awful reviews and the trailer makes it look awful. So as far as I know, none of us has seen that yet, and I don't think we're planning on doing that, right?
If I have a chance to see it, I'll catch it. But I've been so kind of busy and wrapped up with other stuff, I haven't had a chance. But yeah, I don't expect anything from it.
Oddly, I know it's getting terrible reviews, but there was a blog or a Facebook group, and they were talking about it on it. And it was unanimously, everybody liked it a lot. So I guess it's working for quote-unquote horror fans or non-picky horror fans maybe. But, yeah, it doesn't...
Well, I did read something in a review that that was not apparent from watching a trailer, either because the trailer was poorly made or because I wasn't paying close enough attention. But apparently they did carry a character over from the first movie, which I was not aware of, so that's kind of cool.
Oh, that's
besides that's cool. Bagul.
Besides Bagul, yes.
Oh, yes. Very well.
Apparently Deputy So-and-So is a character in Sinister 2.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's supposed to be the lead, maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
And I'm on board with that premise, but it looks like the execution might be crap, so.
Yeah. I don't know.
If any one of you sees it in the theaters and thinks it's, oh my god, you gotta see it, I'll go see it, but otherwise I'm probably waiting for rental.
Right, right. I did see Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, and that was a really good film.
Yeah, so, it is.
Yeah, so you're right, Eric. It's,
I think the Mission Impossibles keep on getting stronger as the series goes on somehow.
True.
I forgot to mention, we did go see American Ultra. American Ultra, it's a weird film because it's with Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I heard about that.
And they basically play like a stoner couple, but you find out from the commercials that Eisenberg is actually like a programmed CIA assassin. And, you know, he gets activated when they come to take him out for reasons. It's hard to know. The justification for taking him out isn't all that good, but it's just an excuse. There's a lot of decent action. It's not a great film, but this is a film that I think people who like action, especially a lot of fairly violent action, will enjoy. Walter Goggins is in it as one of the assassins sent out to take him down.
Walter Goggins. You know, I recently rewatched Shanghai Knights, and Walter Goggins has a small role in that movie, and I did not know who he was when I saw that movie the first time. He plays the obnoxious cowboy, and seeing him in that movie really cracked me up.
Well, that's what I call the Patrick Stewart in Excalibur role.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that I'd watched Excalibur many, many times on cable in the 80s and never taken note of Patrick Stewart.
Liam Neeson, too, in that one.
Or Liam Neeson in Krull would be another one. And it's like, but then you go back and you go, oh my God, Captain Picard's in the middle of the Knights of the Round Table. You know, it's just sort of.
Right. It's funny when you go back and see somebody who is now famous in a movie that you've seen before, but you didn't know who they were when you saw it the first time.
Right.
Yeah. Now, Topher Grace is supposed to be in that one too, besides Walter Goggins, right?
Yes, he basically plays the CIA boss who sends out the hit.
Really?
Interesting.
Yeah, CIA middle management more than CIA boss.
Topher Grace, the guy that played Eric on that 70s show, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Okay. Never really watched it.
All right.
Yeah, but Topher Grace, he was in Spider-Man. He played Spider-Man 3. And he was in another Traffic, the movie Traffic, yeah. As well as, you know, the 70s show, like you said, Eric. Yeah.
Predators.
Yeah, Predators. And so wasn't Walter Goggins in Predators.
Was he?
Topher Grace played the medical serial killer, but Walter Goggins played the scummy serial killer.
Okay, I don't remember. It's been a while since I've seen it.
As opposed to the nice stand-up serial killer.
Right. Right. what about The Man from U.N.C.L.E.? Anybody see that one?
That looks stupid. I have no interest.
Well, it's got pretty good reviews, and it's by Guy Ritchie, and he's a pretty good director. Well, 50-50 is generally. So I was just curious. Has anybody seen that one? Fair enough. And I think that's it for stuff at the theaters. There was a bunch of films that came out for genre-related on VOD, including a Danish film that looked pretty cool, When Animals Dream, and I think that's the next one I'm going to watch. There was a few others, too. Pod, Beneath, and Cop Car looked pretty cool.
Oh, When Animals Dream, I actually watched that. I forgot watched that. Yeah.
Yeah, how was it?
Or is that the one I'm thinking of?
It's Danish.
Hang on. Give me a second. There's another foreign one I just watched. I might be getting confused. I watched Cub. That's also foreign. Sorry, okay. I got confused.
So it's Cub, yeah, not
Cub. I watched. I did not watch When Animals Dream, but I did. It did catch my interest. It's in my section of saved movies.
Yes, yeah, same here. Yeah, and then the last one that I wanted to mention was Cop Car, where Kevin Bacon plays possibly a bad guy, and
also in my saved movies.
Yes, same with me. All right, so that's pretty much all I got. Any other news? Anyone?
Oh, yeah. and upcoming films, because I don't remember if this was, we mentioned it on or off mic last time, but you know, once again, the talking about the dearth of horror films, but you know, there's more coming, and two of the ones coming up that I saw that I thought were good trailers to were for a couple of horror comedies. One was Scouts vs. Zombies, which they had trailers for.
Abe mentioned that one. It's Schwarzenegger's son's in it,
right? Yeah. And
one that was dating Siley Myers or whatever the hell her name is, Miley Cyrus.
Siley Myers.
Whatever.
And the other one was called Final Girls.
Oh yeah, yeah. Hopefully it's not as bad as Final Girl, but Final Girl.
This is just it's basically it's clearly a meta film about slasher films, focusing on like a girl who goes to a festival to watch the slasher movie her mother starred in before she was killed.
Oh, that's
and then
cool.
Gets sucked into the film with her friends. And so it plays up the tropes of being in. And so, of course, nobody can have sex because then they'll die.
Yeah, you'll die.
But the trailer is – I thought the trailer was really good. Whether the movie ends up being as good as the trailer, I don't know. But the trailer was, I think, pretty neat.
What did you guys think of the trailer for The Visit, M. Night Shyamalan's upcoming found footage film?
It looks pretty odd to me.
Yeah, it doesn't look horrible by any means, but yes, it looks a little weird.
I want to give it a chance, but I'm afraid.
Yes.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I could go back and say, look at the trailers for The Happening.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
It didn't look horrible from the trailers.
Yeah,
right,
because we didn't know that it was plants in the wind making everybody crazy.
Oh no, it's the wind.
Wind. Shyamalan could still set up a scene and execute a scene really well, right? And so you have like that scene in The Happening where like the gun gets passed from hand to hand as people commit suicide.
Yeah,
there's
the building.
Yeah, but there's just the glue holding it together kind of sucks. I don't know. Like I get it every time I see like. Could you climb in the oven and help me clean the oven? It's like, I just laugh. I can't help it. And it's,
right.
But it's in a black comedy laugh, not a beast.
It's labeled a horror comedy. It's supposed to be a horror comedy, apparently.
Right. Well, the thing is that even though, like, Mike, you made a good point where it isn't the scene in the trailer where the grandmother says, oh, could you crawl into the oven and clean it? And the camera pans over to the kid, and the kid looks at the camera like, WTF. You know, and so you even laugh a little more. So, I don't think it. I mean, you said it. It's possibly a tongue in cheek, but the trailer kind of makes it look.
It's labeled as one.
Interesting. All right. Well, we'll see. I may check it out if it gets good reviews. If the critics don't give it good reviews, then I won't even bother seeing it. And then a Maze Runner. I'll probably see the Maze Runner too, especially if it gets good reviews. Any other films or trailers or anything, other news, anyone?
Nothing except the big news we're about to talk about.
All right.
Yeah, let's jump to it.
Yeah, let's jump into it. Eric, why don't you let everybody know what this episode's about and what that big news is?
Well, unfortunately, 4 days ago, director, writer, horror icon Wes Craven passed away after a battle with brain cancer. So that's a bummer. He was a huge influence on the entire genre, pretty much back since the 70s. So we're going to talk about his career and some of his notable films tonight as kind of a tribute, because I think we can all say that his films had an impact on how we look at the genre.
Yep, that's true, and we're pretty much going to be winging it, depending on how much each of us prepared, because again, it happened so recently that we literally just changed our topic like 2 days ago and said, let's just do a ad hoc winged episode on the life and films of Wes Craven, or our feelings anyway, because again, we didn't have it planned as where we're going to go through, you know, his whole career from 1972 with The Last House on the Left all the way to present. So we'll probably just jump about. So Eric, let me start with you, because you, I know, Nightmare on Elm Street, which is one of his, or probably, well, second most famous film, maybe after Scream, or first, depending on your perspective. And you always mention it as one of your top 10 best horror films of all time. So let's hear your opinion of Wes Craven, his films, his career.
Well, Wes Craven, you're right. The Nightmare on Elm Street was is high on my list, simply because I'll never forget hearing about it for the first time, because I was in fifth grade and had not yet discovered horror movies. And my quote-unquote girlfriend at the time, that meant we talked on the phone, was trying to describe this movie to me over the phone. And she was telling me about this guy that comes after you in your sleep and has sharp fingernails. And I was like, what are you talking about? This doesn't even make sense. And then it was probably about, 4 years later that I finally ended up seeing it for the first time. And I found it really effective just because the concept, I mean, I had seen Friday the 13th at that point, and that was fun, but, you know, whatever. But I really liked the concept behind A Nightmare on Elm Street, because, man, somebody coming after you in your dreams, that's pretty terrifying when you stop and consider it. So I really enjoyed that concept. And pretty much learned his name and paid attention to films that had it attached to it at that point. And I didn't circle back around to Last House on the Left until years and years later. I think it was the 90s by the time I got around to checking out The Last House on the Left. And The Last House on the Left, I think, was the first movie I've ever watched that made me feel dirty. I watched that movie and I was just like, oh my god, what was that? So he's had a bunch of other influential movies along the way. I consider his career as a whole to be kind of hit and miss. I really enjoyed some of the stuff he did, but some of it was okay, that happened. But yeah, as a whole, his career had a huge influence on the genre. And I've been paying attention to it since 1984 myself. What about you?
Yeah, Abe, how about you first? Because I'm curious, because Scream, which was his last, I guess, humongous film, and that was 19 years ago, and you were a toddler. So I'm curious your perspective of this guy, because his career from Scream and before, you were basically a toddler and not born yet.
My experience with Wes Craven has been all over the place since growing up. I do remember, like, People Under the Stairs, I remember it was one of the earliest films of his I've seen. A very strange film, but enjoyable nonetheless, in my opinion. But I think most of the films I was exposed of his were most of the ones he was a producer in, rather than the ones he directed. And yeah, I remember Scream being a big deal for a lot of people. My memory is very vague on that one. All his films have been like a big hit and miss for me. I remember, like, which one was it? As I said, People on the Stairs, it was not exactly scary, kind of on the silly side, very weird. I remember seeing some of Scream, and it was mostly supposed to be a comedy as well. It was on the silly side, what I would call it. Wishmaster was another one. Wishmaster, the Jin film.
I don't think that was his.
Well, as I'm saying, that was the one he produced. He was involved with. But I'm saying most of the films I've seen that he was attached to was mostly the ones he's been a producer in.
Okay.
Like he was involved in a number of the remakes of a number of films of his. Like, I remember he was a producer in the remake for The Hills Have Eyes. I remember he was Last House on the Left remake as well. He was attached to.
Yeah, he was a producer for that. He was a producer for Feast.
I thought Feast was pretty fun. I know he directed Curse, and I really hate that film. That was pretty terrible, in my opinion. He was a producer in The Breed, which was a very strange vampire film. Yeah,
he produced Dracula 2000, which I personally think is underrated.
It's okay. I mean, I didn't think it was terrible as some people make it out to be. I mean, yeah. I think it gets nailed a little too hard by folks.
Yeah, I would agree with both of you guys. It's a little underrated. It's not as bad as some folks thought it was.
Yeah. I kind of liked They a bit, which we produced. I mean, the idea of being selected by dark creatures as a child and waiting constantly for them to try to claim you later on. I thought that was cool. The execution was kind of off, though. But overall, I mean, the films he's directed and produced and just had a hand in crafting just kind of shaped my view on films in general, as well as just how the general audience has been receptive to them and to the growing the evolution of horror.
Yep. What about you, Mike?
The first film I remember seeing from Craven, it certainly has to be one of the all-time greatest superhero movies ever made, and I'm talking, of course, of Swamp Thing, which seemed like it was on constant rotation on cable in the 80s. So I saw it many, many, many times as a kid.
I've never caught up with that one, actually.
It is cheesy as hell. It's got Adrian Barbeau. I'm trying to remember the actor's name who was the villain. Louis Jordan is the villain. And I just always found this fun. It's funny because in some ways that film ends up spurring on the entire comic book renaissance in the mid-80s, because the film was really cheesy. The comic book was awful, and so before they canceled it, they handed it over to Alan Moore, who turned it into something awesome, and it became a surprise hit and avoided cancellation. And then, of course, Alan Moore goes on to do Watchmen, and that ended up being a cultural bomb in the mid-90s, mid-80s, rather. So that's probably, if I have, like, actual, like, real affection for a film, even though I have not watched it in years, that he's made, that if I'm going to be confessed, that's probably the one that I have the soft, warm, fuzzy spot in my heart for, even though it's not a really good movie. And it's just a weird thing with Craven. It's a love-hate relationship, because he's got a lot of good movies and he's got a lot of crap. And even if you move the stuff that he produced, because produced could be anything. Produced could be, you know, they're there telling, you know, yelling at the director every day because he's fucking up. Or produced could be, yeah, put my name on it, just send the check to Wes Craven. You know, and I don't know really where he was on the everything he produced. I know, like, most of the remakes, he was fairly hands off. I remember Nightmare on Elm Street in theaters, not knowing how big that film was going to end up being. But I think the guy has produced in the horror genre, you have four arguable classics in Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Scream, right? Those are, mm-hmm. especially Nightmare on Elm Street and Scream are going in the Horror Hall of Fame.
Yes. Right.
And those would be, you know, first ballot inductees in the Horror Hall of Fame.
Yes.
And then with that, you also have two of the most iconic characters in horror history, in Freddy and Ghostface.
Yes.
And he designed, or had a lot to do with, the look of both of those. So there's a lot of directors out there who produce a lot of shit and never stumble into making one classic, let alone four. Right? I mean, yeah. And you look at something like the remake of Nightmare on Elm Street and how the scenes that directly aped the original film just don't they just don't, they don't work. They don't catch it the same way. They don't have nearly the same impact. So when someone directly copies your work and they can't do as good a job, then that has to say something about the quality of what you did the first time around.
Well, that's true. Just to play devil's advocate, it also could mean it was fresh and new versus, you know, everybody now repeats the same thing over and over and over, and so it's not fresh and new anymore. So
yeah, sometimes that's the case, but like when I can watch like the scene with the hand coming out of the wall while she's in bed.
No, yeah.
You know, that's how it's staged. You know, it's effective in one film, it's not as effective in the other. You know, and it's simply staging. It's how it's shot. The scene in the bathtub, it's how it and how it's presented. Now I know, like you mentioned, something like Cursed, which I still have not watched, but I've heard nothing but horrible things about the production involved in that film, and I have no idea why that went off the rails. I think he has some other films. I still haven't seen Red Eye. I have it. I own it. I just haven't watched it.
It's a great film,
and I've heard a lot of good things about that. I remember Music of the Heart was one of the first film. It was a film Pam and I went to see before we were married. Was his sort of I want to be taken as a taken seriously as a director film, and I thought that was effective. New Nightmare, I think it was like proto Scream, right? I mean, it was.
Oh, I love New Nightmare,
and
think it's talked about enough.
Yeah, and yeah, you know, I think that a lot of the Nightmare films kind of went down the crapper as you get past the third entry, but you know, it's there. Serpent and the Rainbow, I think, falls apart for me in the last act, but I think the rest of it is really good. I know like movies like Shocker has its fans, so. You know, it's not really, as I'm looking over what he did as a director, let's forget the stuff he just lent his name to as a producer. The stuff he actually did, it's really is a pretty good resume. And certainly for people in the horror genre, it's very respectable.
That's true.
And the other thing I mentioned is that, you know, I've seen him in a lot of interviews and I've, you know, heard a lot of people, like there are certain people in the horror genre that you know of, like John Carpenter. Sometimes you get the sense could be a bit of a cantankerous ass at times. Some people, you know, get a reputation really difficult to work with. And I've never heard anybody say anything but really nice things about Wes Craven. You know, and I didn't mean, by the way, to be pushing Carpenter down, but it's just that he's, you know, he could be difficult. He's very demanding, right? We were going to be doing a Jim Cameron film, and he's got a horrible reputation as being a bastard to work for. Now, yep. But of course, everybody will still work with him because they'll say that the fact that he's a bastard to work for is what makes him so good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he's still a bastard to work for.
Well, and that's, you know, there's just no way around. You, there's just many different styles of successful direction of movies,
right? And you'd say, makes you say, maybe you don't have to be a bastard, but that's a whole other matter. But the fact is, he seemed to be a good guy. You know, from top to bottom, you don't hear stories of, my God, he was such an asshole on set. You know, you don't hear that from the actresses who worked with, like, so, and it would make sense then when you get, like, you know, bringing Heather Langenkamp back years later to do Nightmare on Elm Street, to do a new Nightmare, you know, to keep getting, all the people in the Scream franchise back for those sequels. So, and I think that Scream 4 is a swan song was not a bad sign off.
No, right. I think that was an underrated film. I think that's the best Scream after the original.
Yes, itself. I agree.
Yeah. But yeah, for me, I can honestly say I haven't really seen much of his work. I mean, a lot of folks, you know, are probably saying heresy, but I pretty much had the same experience with you, Mike, that Swamp Thing, watch it. You know, over and over when it was on HBO back in the early 80s. It was a fun film, and it's now got a new presentation on Scream Factory, though it's missing like 3 or 4 minutes from the original release, so that's some folks aren't interested in buying the Scream Factory and are hoping to have a new version come out later. But my first real experience with him was in 1996 with Scream, where the girl I was seeing at the time, she wanted to see this film. I said, all right, let's go see it. And to be honest, I have to say that Scream may be my first real horror film, modern horror film that I saw. Because in the 80s, I didn't watch any horror films that were released in the 80s except for The Thing. Because, and maybe Fright Night. Because most of them were R-rated and I just never bothered seeing them at the theaters. And then the VCR store, I never bothered going to the horror section because I thought they were all just garbage and trash. So I would always go to dramas and things like that. So I didn't have any experience of 80s horror films until within the past 8 years or so. So Scream completely surprised me, and I thought it was an absolutely fantastic film. That's my experience with Wes Craven. And then, so, you know, like a lot of things, when I like a good film, I then go out and rent various other films by that director, though I have not done so as much as, say, John Carpenter, which I've seen pretty much every film he's done. So my affection for Wes Craven hadn't been as big, say, as it was for, say, someone like John Carpenter. I do know a couple of things that were interesting about his career. One is that he got his break with Last House on the Left in 1972 because a producer named Sean Cunningham decided to make a quote-unquote horror film cheap. And he was buddies with this guy named Wes Craven, so they put the film together. And for folks who don't know who Sean Cunningham is, even though I know Eric probably does based off his little laugh there, Sean Cunningham was the director of Friday the 13th. And so they kind of had interesting how they hand in hand their careers both took off in the early 70s.
What's kind of a neat neat note on that is that I actually own the original uncut version of Last House on the Left on DVD, and they have a commentary track on there with both of them. And the first 20 minutes of that movie are pretty uneventful, just setting up the story. And then stuff starts to go down, and basically both of them for the remainder of the movie on the commentary are just like, oh, we're sorry. Oh, we're so sorry. Because the adults they grew up to be really don't appreciate the movie they made back then, because it really is just, it's some nasty stuff. It really, really is. So it's kind of funny to listen to the commentary now and hear the older Sean Cunningham and Wes Craven give their thoughts on the movie that the younger Wes Craven and Sean Cunningham made.
It is funny. I have that disc too, and I've listened to that commentary as well. It's a hoot and definitely worth getting the disc just to hear the commentary, even if you aren't a fan of that film. Also, there was another interesting fact I liked about Craven was how him, Matt Damon, and Ben Affleck did Project Greenlight together. And I thought that was pretty cool, where they chose a script and a director to put them together and make a cheap film. And in this season of Project Greenlight, which used to be a program where they were trying to Ben Affleck and Matt Damon were trying to help young filmmakers, that season was the topic was horror film. And Feast, the movie Feast, came out of that. And the writers of that film were some of the guys that did the Saw franchise, part of the all the sequels. And then the director was John Gallagher's son, the guy from Return of the Living Dead, the owner of the warehouse. His son actually directed Feast. So I thought that was kind of cool. Any other thoughts that you guys wanted to mention about Craven and his film, since I just brought up a couple myself?
Well, I want to remind everybody, we do have an episode of Dark Discussions in which we discuss Last House on the Left, both the original and the remake.
That's right. Yep. Eric had been out of town that week, so me, Abe, and Mike just randomly picked the film to do, and we decided
that was a fun topic there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a weird film because there's a lot of very effective stuff in Last House on the Left, but there's also that weird deputy stuff. Like the sheriffs, you know,
right?
And the thing is, you know, Craven wasn't a horror guy. He never watched a horror movie. He came from a strong religious family. Got kind of pulled into, was a like an English professor or something in college.
Yeah, he's highly educated, highly educated.
And then got dragged into film editing. He apparently shot a number of porno films.
Yeah.
Under a pseudonym.
That's how him and Cunningham met, because Cunningham used to produce some of those softcore or whatever type films.
So when he said, like, I want you to direct a horror movie, he's like, I never saw a horror movie. He had no idea what to do. So that probably explains some of the tonal inconsistencies that you got in Last House on the Left, right? Is somebody kind of finding their legs. But certainly starting out as a film editor probably helped them keep, because he knows how to tell a story. You know, again, that's what it comes down to a lot. And we got a lot of directors now who cut their teeth in, I don't know if it's a big thing anymore, but it used to cut, a lot of them had been, and coming up in the 90s and the 2000s, had cut their teeth doing music videos. But music videos, you just make pretty images. You don't have to tell a story. Mm-hmm. And so we got a lot of beautiful looking films that can't tell a freaking story. You know, and certainly Craven can keep you back on the story. And I do think, like I said, there's a few here and there of his that I haven't seen yet. But I would still say, like, The Hills Have Eyes is one – I didn't see that until much later.
I rewatched that earlier today.
I think I saw it probably when I was around 30 or so. So it's – and so it was already like a 25-year-old film. Mm-hmm. And it still packs a punch, man. It's it creeped me the hell out. Now, admittedly, Hillbilly Mutant Rape is kind of a creepy concept all on its own.
Yeah.
So it's a cheap shot, but you know, he went there. There is something.
He also did something that Phil wouldn't approve of.
Oh, yes. killing a dog. Yes.
Yes.
The dog wasn't killed. He was acting.
Well, you know what though? John Carpenter had killed the dog in Halloween.
Yeah.
And he killed several in The Thing.
Well, yes, but the dog in the end is the one who triumphs in the end, right? He's he's the survivor.
That's true. I've never gotten back to listen to the episode you guys did on Last House of the Left. What were your quick thoughts on the remake?
Oddly, the episode was supposed to mostly focus on the remake, but we really mostly talked about Wes Craven's original, which was kind of odd. For my opinion of the remake, I love the remake. I thought the remake was one of the better films I've seen when I got back into horror in the past 10 years. Because I hadn't, again, after Scream, I kind of just disappeared out of modern horror films again until pretty much the reproduced film Last House on the Left and then The Descent. Those were the two films that brought me back into modern horror. And Stephen King actually mentions and says that Last House on the Left, in his opinion, is possibly the best film of the decade, too. So that was pretty impressive thing, and he wrote a big article about that in Fangoria. So it wasn't just one of his, you know, giving his name for a blurb. You know, he actually wrote a whole article and explained why he thought it was one of the best horror films in the past 10 years. So it's kind of interesting. What about you, Mike or Abe or even you, Eric? What's your opinion of the remake versus the original?
Well, you know, I gotta say, I loved most of the movie. But you know how I am. My brain latches onto things.
Yeah,
won't let go. So the last scene of the movie just really kind of ruined the rest of it for me, because I was just like sitting there, like every nerve in my body wanting to scream at this. That can't happen like that.
Yeah, but
you still have no trouble with Bruce the Shark throwing Ben Gardner's head back in the boat.
Right.
Well, yeah, I had the same issue as well, Eric, with that last scene. I just felt, I don't know, it just kind of really got, I don't know, it kind of screwed the tone of the rest of the film. I don't know, felt off.
I thought 99% of it was a really good movie, and then the last scene just fucking, just put a really sour note on the end of it for me.
Well, the advantage is because it's a more polished film, certainly than the original. And so there are those rough spots, and boy, are they rough in the original. You know, and it's really the sheriff stuff. So it's just such a weird divergence. But anyway, so that stuff is gone, and so you get it's a decent film. I think Craven has actually been pretty well blessed with the remakes, in that both Last House on the Left and The Hills Have Eyes remake, mm-hmm. you know, are both really good films. They do not necessarily upstage or take away the originals, but you also don't watch them thinking, why am I watching this when the original was still there? I could just watch. You know, it's they work as their own standalone things, even though they both kind of come close to it. You know, the Nightmare on Elm Street remake, you know, that's another matter. I think that's, you know, people, I mean, are really harsh towards that one.
Well, I think people were just waiting to hate on that one.
I don't think it's
as bad as everybody greeted it, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, to me, that's another entry in a franchise. You know, you didn't get. I know you had Hills Have Eyes 2, right? But you really didn't get a Hills Have Eyes franchise or a Last House on the Left franchise. To me, it's another Nightmare on Elm Street movie. It's retelling the first story. And is it as good as the original? No. Is it as good, but is, you know, is it something that doesn't deserve any, you know, comparison to Freddy's Dead or, Dream Child? You know, I think they could have done much worse. It's unfortunate it wasn't a better movie. And I really do think.
No, it was not a better movie.
I really do think that I liked what the actor, blanking on his name.
Jackie Earl Haley?
Jackie Earl Haley. I liked his take on Freddy. I like the way he did it.
Yeah, me too.
You know, and it wasn't his. You know, people say, oh, he's terrible. He wasn't funny. Well, he wasn't asked to be funny.
He was asked to be scary,
you have to – this is how things like this work is that the director says, you're going to be a scary Freddy. And the actor says, no, I wouldn't be funny Freddy. And the director says, you're fired. Right, that's how that works.
That is how that goes. Yes, yes.
On with the very rare occasion that you get like a Jack Nicholson or something, where the only reason your movie got funded is because they're in it.
Yeah.
But then you run into disasters like the Marlon Brando Island of Dr. Moreau.
Well, I just read a piece of trivia earlier today that apparently Jackie Earl Haley was friends with Johnny Depp when Johnny Depp got the part in the first movie.
Interesting.
Yeah, there you go. Nobody credits him with discovering Johnny Depp, now do they?
Right? No, it was introducing Johnny Depp, wasn't it, in Nightmare on Elm Street?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
That's right.
Yeah, this was years before. Well, I mean, really what made Johnny Depp was 21 Jump Street.
Yes.
That's right.
Right? Which turned him into a teen heartthrob. But that was years after Nightmare on Elm Street.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, he even has a little cameo in the remake.
Well, and I think one of the interesting things about Wes Craven as a director is that when he started out, he had no idea what the hell he was doing. Like Phil was saying, The Last House on the Left, he'd never done that before. It was 1972, so there's a climactic scene at the end where two people are fighting, and one of them has a chainsaw, and the other one's fending them off with a chair. So he's like, hey, you, take this chainsaw. You, take this chair. Don't let him hit you. And you can't do that like that anymore. But it certainly makes for an effective scene.
Right, and I have to think that his lack of experience in the genre, especially in those early films, benefits because, like Hills Have Eyes, all right, now mutants, rape everybody. And you got to think like somebody's like, Wes, what? You can't do that. What do you mean we can't do that? That's bad. Well, but we can stab them, but we can't stick them with a penis?
Jeez.
No, that's not the rules, Wes. We can't do that.
Now steal the baby. Wait,
right?
Wes.
But like Last House on the Left and Hills Have Eyes really just kind of stomp all over the taboos of horror films, right? Even stuff like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, mm-hmm. you know, did a bit with cannibalism, right? But he didn't seem, whether it's because he was deliberately going against what the conventions told him he couldn't do, or if he just had no clue what the conventions were and so just went ahead and said, well, that would be scary. Mm-hmm. You know, and that added something certainly to that. And I do think you know, Nightmare has is probably his most brilliant creation in terms of conceptually the idea of a dream demon.
Well, because, and again, he didn't know what he was doing. There's one of the best scenes in that movie is when, well, spoiler alert, Johnny Depp bites it. And there's a scene where a fountain of blood comes out of his bed. In order to achieve that effect, they actually had a room on a pivot so you could kind of turn it around like it was on a spit. It's how they did the scene where Tina died. So they used that same set to do this fountain of blood. Only they forgot that liquid has weight, and once all that blood started pouring out onto the set that rotates, the weight started making the set rotate of its because like gravity. So the whole set ended up basically spinning around. Wes Craven was like strapped in a chair. Basically on an amusement park ride, spinning around this room, and all the power cords got snapped and everything, and he ended up like basically stranded, strapped in his chair while everybody tried to figure out how to get him out of there without getting electrocuted. So again, he ends up with this fantastic scene in the movie that really can't be replicated and really shouldn't be replicated because he almost died doing it.
It was a brilliant shot. It was absolutely stunning. I mean, and it's funny how little accidents can make a scene.
And you would think this is 10 years after he's been doing this. You'd think he would have figured something out by then.
He hadn't discovered gravity yet.
But well, yeah, and Abe, you're right. There's that concept of serendipity, you know, is the happy accident.
Yeah.
That happens so often in a lot of films where things happen that nobody planned on. Have you heard or read anything from any of the Tarantino stuff recently that came out?
About Wes Craven or just him talking about his favorite stuff?
He was talking about his favorite stuff, but they were talking about – the Scream came up. They said, you know, why didn't you – he had directed a horror film, and I guess he was offered Scream at some point or for some reason, or he said he would have done it. But he did kind of say that he felt that Wes Craven's didn't feel right for the film. He thought the direction kind of held the film back. I don't know how he, considering how awesome most of us think the film is.
Hold it. So Quentin Tarantino said he thought Scream wasn't that good.
Well, I don't know. Did he say he didn't think it was that good? I think he said Wes Craven's direction wasn't that good.
Oh my God, that's insane! That Scream was friggin' an unbelievable film all around. That's
ridiculous. Actually gave that another watch a couple of years ago. It had been a long time since I'd seen it, and I'd actually forgotten how good it is.
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic film. I mean, to be honest, you could actually say that was my first slasher film I ever saw, and yeah. I went in, you know, not even knowing what a slasher film would be like, and I come out like, oh my God, if every slasher is like this, this is a great genre. And
no, they're not even close.
right. But I'll never forget going to see that movie in the theater. It's actually one of the first movies I saw in a theater when I moved to Michigan. And I was sitting there watching this movie, and Drew Barrymore is in the movie, right? And I think they did a pretty good marketing job of this without, because they pretty much made you think she was the big star of the movie, right?
Right.
And so then you get in there, and spoiler alert for Scream, I can't believe anybody who's listening to this hasn't seen that.
Spoiler alert for Scream, just for those of us older folks, a movie that is now 20 years old.
Oh Jesus, yes,
almost.
Yeah, so she bites it in the very first scene of the movie, and I'm just watching this going, oh what? Oh my God. So what? I really have no idea what's going to happen next. This is awesome.
The decoy protagonist syndrome.
Yeah. If there's an earlier instance of that, I don't know what it is off the top of my head.
Well, Psycho, right? But that was.
Oh, yeah. No, good call. But that was 30 years prior.
Well, what is 30 years prior, but also she was still in about half the film before they killed her off.
True. Right. True.
Yeah, she had a big part before she, you know, took the knife.
The thing that was interesting about Scream 2 is after I saw that film, I'm thinking, oh my God, all these people are future superstars, because all the actors in the film played the role so well that it never occurred to me that, you know, they were just going to be great in this film and that's it. So, you know, because none of them really had big roles after that. I mean, they had,
well,
you know.
I don't know if I'd say that, but.
Well, I'm not talking about Courtney Cox.
It's definitely standout roles for a lot of them.
Yeah, Courtney Cox, and obviously is different, but the rest of the crew.
I am shocked that Neve Campbell pretty much dropped off the face of the planet.
Yeah, she dropped off. Rose McGowan had a pretty decent career.
Let's not forget Skeet Ulrich.
Well, yeah, he's a guy that what was he wasn't in anything. And Matthew Lillard, right? I mean, it's just
isn't Matthew Lillard married to Buffy? He gets to bone Buffy, isn't that basically?
No. That's
Freddie Prinze. Freddie Prinze.
Yeah, Freddie Prinze.
That was it. Okay.
Yeah. And that's the funny thing is that Freddie Prinze met her in that movie
last summer.
Yeah, exactly. And in this film here, Scream, Courtney Cox and.
David Arquette,
yeah, before they finally divorced after like 20 years, but that's what the film that made them meet up, so. That was a curiosity, I thought. The film didn't necessarily have any big names, but it just blew up at the box office, and I guess, like you said, it was based around Drew Barrymore, and she was the big person at the time, and she was only in it for 10 minutes.
Yeah. But man, what 10 minutes, man! What an opening scene!
I am curious as to in the earlier part of his career, he was a director for a majority of his films, but then later on, he became a producer for a good portion of them. I wonder what changed within that era.
Money.
Yeah. Well, you know, you make your films, and then you retire and you go play golf, and. So you'll just be a producer, which is, like Mike said, give you a name, and that's about it. That would be my guess. I don't know. I mean, it's a little different. It's like John Carpenter. He never really did that. But Craven, well, yeah, he was really into production after a while. But don't know. Myself and Abe don't know. And Eric, you said money. What about you, Mike? Do you have any ideas?
Well, some of it, I know he had things that he was doing that fell apart. They were going to do, he wrote or co-wrote the screenplay for an adaptation of Pulse that never ended up getting made he had made it with Vince Gilligan from Breaking Bad.
Mm-hmm.
But like that went nowhere. And sometimes that's what happens to some of these directors. Like you say, well, you haven't made anything. It's like, because everything I tried to get off the ground, just go, you know, falls apart. Plus, yeah, I mean, it's, you get, I'm trying to look, I mean, was it, he stopped doing, he didn't make the Scream films. He did My Soul, that was, I never saw, haven't seen it, that very, pretty received.
It wasn't great.
So.
Yeah, they said that Curse and that Soul to Take were kind of, mediocre. So they were.
Well, see, like I'm looking. You got movies in '98, in '99, in 2000, 2001, 2002,
holy
2003,
crap.
2004, 2005, 2006. So like 2000. So 2004 was a couple of documentaries he was in, and he produced in 2003. 2005, he had Cursed and Red Eye. Now, Cursed was probably, you know, that explains the gap, because Cursed was...
Is that the one with What's-Her-Face in it?
Yes.
Richie.
The short one?
Yeah, Richie. Christina Richie is her name?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So, Cursed was delayed, right? So that's probably something that would have been in that gap of 2002, 2003, right? In that early 2000s, that's where that film would have been.
Right.
And then Red Eye, you know, didn't have that delay problem, so that was 2005. And you know, that point is 2005, that was 10 years ago, he would have been 65 at that point.
Right.
So, I mean, it's possible Hollywood being what it is, just stop calling him, especially since Cursed bombed.
Mm-hmm.
And right. Red Eye wasn't anything to write home about.
Well, it actually, it was a fantastic film. Got fantastic.
But
reviews.
I mean, in terms of business.
Yeah, right, right. And it was the film that pretty much, along with Mean Girls, made Rachel McAdams as a star, or at least a semi-star, anyway. But continue.
Speaking of business, I'm staring at a list on Wikipedia right now of his highest-grossing films.
Okay.
And I am shocked that the original Nightmare on Elm Street is not on this list. People under number 10's People Under the Stairs with $31 million. Then Nightmare on Elm Street 3 with 44.
Oh, Nightmare on Elm Street 3?
Yeah.
Okay, well.
So they're including stuff he produced. They're including stuff he produced.
Yeah, because he only produced that. Yeah, he didn't. Yeah.
Then Last House on the Left Remake with $45 million.
Okay, yeah, he produced it.
The Hills Have Eyes 2 with $67 million. The Hills Have Eyes remake with $69 million, Red Eye with $95 million, and then in descending order, the Scream movies: Scream 4, 3, 2, 1, with four clocking in with $101 million, and Scream clocking in with $173 million.
Yeah, but I think the fact that you have Red Eye, which is 2005, the Hills Have Eyes and Hills Have Eyes 2, those are both. I mean, it's not his Hills Have Eyes Part 2. That's the remake Hills Have Eyes 2, right? So these are all movies that are made of more recent vintage. The remake of Last House on the Left, you know, they made their money because they aren't charging $3 for a ticket anymore the way they were when they made the original Nightmare on Elm Street.
That's right. True, yes.
Right, so
they're not adjusted for inflation.
Right, so I mean, I would pretty much take everything that he just produced, the Hills Have Eyes, Hills Have Eyes 2, Last House on the Left, and remove them from consideration. Then you throw out the fact that Red Eye and the others, Red Eye came out in 2005, you know, so you're dealing with $8, $9, $10 tickets, you know, so that drives the price up. You know, and Scream was a legitimate phenomenon. The fact that Scream 4 made only $100 million and came out 12 years after Scream 3, something like that.
Yeah, right.
You know, that. Again, this is why you always should go for adjusted gross and not the original, because that really says how far the horror genre has fallen in for Hollywood. Uh-huh. I imagine Nightmare on Elm Street original is probably not far behind.
The actual number is $25 million for the original.
Okay. Huh. And that's also would have been a film which happens with, which is rare with horror films, that they get bigger as they go on. But Nightmare, I'm sure, was a phenomenon on video.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. It was also a box office success because I'm sure anybody who's watched the documentary on the Nightmare on Elm Street movies it knows that New Line Cinema was known as the house that Freddy built. They were about to go bankrupt before that hit the theaters, and it saved the entire studio.
And that's why Robert Englund should have been cast as Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings films.
actually, he could have done it. You're absolutely right. But my story with the Nightmare on Elm Street is interesting, guys. A buddy of mine at the time, he was really into the big giant VHS boxes of horror films that you find at video stores, and he got Nightmare on Elm Street when it came out on VHS, and he rented it like 3 or 4 times, and he came over to my house once, and me and my mother were there, and he goes, "Oh, you got to see this horror film; it's just unbelievable." And so we put it in, and it was actually I thought it was pretty scary at the time. Though now I look back, it wasn't. But we only watched like 15 to 20 minutes of the film because my mother immediately had to say, "All right, you got to shut this off." When the girl, was it Tina, that goes up on the ceiling?
Yeah.
And my mother goes, "Okay.
That's enough."
Yeah, so we're these 15-year-olds, and it's like, okay, this is an R-rated film, pretty gross.
That's another case where Wes fools you, because at the beginning of that movie, you think Tina's going to be your final girl, and then they offer like 20 minutes into the movie.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, Eric, what makes you love that film so much? Was it simply because of fond memories as a kid, or just like a lot of folks part just of it. Love it was, the character or of Freddy or
Freddy
really
Freddy was something that was just referenced among my friends growing up as part of my childhood memories, which is always, you know, nostalgia will get you every time. I also just find the concept as far as the underlying concept is, you know, it's not realistic at all, but conceptually creeps me out. The concept of somebody being able to hurt you in your dreams is just terrifying. And what's even weirder is that Wes Craven was actually inspired by, a series of articles in the LA Times about, somebody in Korea, I think it was, that actually didn't want to go to sleep because he was afraid of this whatever in his dreams hunting him. And then when he finally went to sleep, he died. And that was his inspiration for coming up with a story. So it's like probably not Freddy Krueger, but there was something weird going on with that dude. So who's to say it's like never happened? So I just love the concept. And then getting to New Nightmare later on, I particularly enjoyed that concept as well. The concept of just something becoming so embedded in the culture, in society, that it actually takes on a real life from fiction. I like that concept as well. So I like this freaky concepts on the Friday movies.
I would also throw in the visuals. Freddy himself is a great visual. And I love, like, just for psychology, a lot of people don't realize the colors of his sweater are red and green.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people who think they're like red and black.
Really?
Because it's usually bad lighting. It's usually very dark. And these are not probably your diehard horror fans. But he picked those because, psychologically, it's like those are two colors that your brain has trouble seeing when they're next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's why it used to be 3D, right? Green and red.
Right. So we realized that would make people uncomfortable is using that particular color scheme. Because if you think about it, how about we have somebody in a Christmas sweater as a villain? Right? It sounds like a weird thing, but there was, again, Phil mentions was a well-read and educated man.
Yeah.
This is a good example of him putting that into play. You know, you have the claws, you know, gives the certainly is a literal manifestation of the predator, you know, of something almost bestial. But just, you know, again, the Freddy is so different in that first film. He makes some lewd remarks, but he wasn't doing a stand-up routine the way he was by the time he got to Freddy's Dead.
Right.
Now you're playing with power. You're not doing that, right?
Right.
He's a perv, and he was supposed to be a child killer. He was supposed to be a pedophile.
Yes.
But they decided
at the last minute not to do that because that actually happened in California right before they released the movie.
Well, but this is, again, Wes, you're not allowed. It's like you can kill people, you can't rape them. Okay, so I can have a story about a child killer, but not a child toucher.
Right.
Okay.
Jeez.
But I, you know, there's all sorts of images of Freddy in that film that just work. They're just creepy images, you know, and that's not the, Robert Englund mugging for the camera stuff you got in some later films. That's just how the audience is like the character, and that's the version of the character that's endured. But the first one is the version that started it off. Then you can understand why the film has so much more bite than most of the other entries eventually would.
Well, and I think somebody like Abe, for instance, could also appreciate just the masterpiece of practical effects going on in that original
movie. Oh, such good practical effects there. I'm sure, which one was the one where he turns into that big hand and starts eating the girl alive?
Oh, God, I don't remember.
He turns into a snake?
Yeah.
It was 4 or 5, wasn't it? Was it 3?
I think it was 3, yeah.
Yeah, I see it. There's so many interesting, cool moments, even in some of the sequels, but, you know, it's been such a long time.
Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
You know? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, the practical effects, I mean, this is mid-80s. A couple of things that were interesting about that film. I know me and Mike aren't huge fans of it, as a lot of horror fans are. I think we've discussed that in prior episodes here and there. But we did, I have to admit that a couple of things that were interesting in it, and I read about it in the past week since its passing. But the first was, is it was not a typical slasher. I mean, at the time, slashers and slashes and slashes and slashes and slashes were coming out. And then suddenly, boom, this weird film that is kind of a slasher, but it's also a monster movie, and it's based in fantasy rather than in, you know, just a serial killer slashing people, killing people, whatever, in the woods. And that's what made it stick out big time. First off. And then another thing they mentioned that was really cool about the film is that they simply said that the character Freddy, unlike other big name characters of that era, like the Michael Myers or Jason, or even a little earlier than that, which simply was a Texas Chainsaw, the Leatherface guy, is that back in those days, and Wes Craven said it, he specifically said that back in the day, those characters, all you needed was a stuntman and a mask. Well, Robert Englund, basically he made Robert Englund's career, because here it is, he got this guy, brought him in, put him on camera, and he made a character out of a monster, and it made his career, you know, to what we know Robert Englund of today, when in fact most monsters back in those days were just stuntmen and masks. And that's a direct quote from Wes Craven.
Right. I'd interviewed at one of the conventions I went to, Monster Mania a couple of years ago, Dick Warlock, who did The Shape or did Michael Myers for Halloween 2. And if I remember, I asked, how did you get the job as Michael Myers? He said, I was there. You know, is that he was the sun guy. You want to put on the mask? Sure, I'll put the mask on. So, yeah, that was it. And this is why people, when we say, well, we're rebooting, we're going to have a new Friday the 13th. And people go, you know, is it going to be found footage? No, don't worry. Oh, okay, that's great. When they say, we're going to reboot Nightmare on Elm Street again. And they go, is it going to be Robert Englund? They said, he doesn't want to put the makeup on anymore. He's getting old. And it's a pain in the ass. And people, oh, no, don't do that. You have to have Robert Englund. You know, it's we care about Robert Englund. Nobody – the diehard Friday fans may care about which Jason is in the mask.
Right.
But most people don't know and don't give a shit.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, 80% of the people that would go see the film are teenagers that don't even care about who's behind the mask.
Right, and this is by the way, it's why I would argue a lot of time if you want to get – if you want to get nitpicky, you know, that Freddy really isn't a slasher. But, like, cause slashers have certain hallmarks of the slasher genre. Mask, a lot of point of view, POV shots, and they're people. You know, Freddy may have been a slasher when he was alive, but he's a ghost, or a ghost demon, or some sort of supernatural entity, and that makes him different from...
Yeah.
I don't know, though. He goes around with a glove that's knives and slashes people with them.
And for the most part,
he's kind of a slasher.
And if you actually watch the films, what he does mostly with that glove is twiddle his fingers.
Just kind of too many people.
He just like to fuck with people a lot.
Right, and then he turns into a snake and eats somebody. You know, it's...
Or
makes them jump off a building, or, you know... shoves their head into television. He does. He's not like hitting all the time. Just with chopped your head off. Yay! Move on to the next version.
Well, Freddy's more about trickery and illusions,
right?
And mind games than compared to like Jason Voorhees, who's about brute strength and ferocity.
Well, and that's what I said earlier is that Craven in the middle of the slasher movement took a monster movie and a slasher and combine them together. And that's what kind of makes it unique because, you know, if you look at all the other guys, Jason and Michael Myers and Leatherface and whatever, not including, you know, sequels that changed everything up, but the original films were all human beings that were just murderers. And, you know, that's cool. But at the time when everybody was doing that, Craven comes out and says, I'll make a demon slash, you know, mystical beast that's a slasher instead.
And another thing with a lot of those slashers, traditionally, again, maybe this may just be that Craven not knowing or not giving a shit what the rules are. They're sympathetic characters who had something wrong done to them, right? Jason was this disfigured, handicapped child who drowned in the lake because reasons, because stuff happened. The burning was, what was he, a janitor or something, custodian or lawn groundskeeper who got set up and scared by the local kids and set himself on fire and died, you know, and ended up in a hospital. They all have these like sympathetic backstories. And Freddy has sort of that, except that, you know, he was a child killer.
Right.
Right. It's like, it's not that he was innocent. It's like he didn't get a trial or he got off in his trial. But he was still a fucking child killer.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't the innocent person framed for being a child killer. That's
well,
why
he wasn't innocent, but he was wronged because he got off on a technicality for the murders, and so the parents torched him alive.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's brutal, but I don't know that I could say he was wrong. He was legally, you know, what they did wasn't correct, and you can argue about the ethics of vigilantism. But the last person to complain about being set on fire is the who killed the children of the people who's setting him on fire. He's like, no, you can't set me on fire. I know I killed your boy, but it was a technicality. I'm free. You know, it's, you know, he wasn't sitting home. He didn't use his.
All I'm saying is that he had motivation.
His glove for chopping onions.
That's all I'm saying. He had motivation.
Well, yeah.
But messed up motivation of a villain.
Well, he was murdered, and then because of vigilanteism, and so now he's coming back to do the same thing, which is vigilanteism back. It never stops. It's a cycle.
Yes.
So, so he does have reasons, even if he's a bad guy when he was alive, never mind as a demon or as a ghost or whatever you want to call
it. Or whatever the hell he is. They give like 5 different explanations throughout the series of movies.
Yeah. Now, besides Scream and Nightmare, because I know, Eric, you're going to say Nightmare, and I'm going to say Scream as my favorite film by Craven. What about you, Mike? Which out of all his films do you, and you know, you can be the funny person and go, well, I'll say it's The Serpent in the Rain. But seriously, what's out of the...
Well, like I said, I have, for nostalgia reasons only, I have that special place in my heart for Swamp Thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But the film of his, and I think I've only seen it the one time, the one that even to this day thing that just still gets under my skin is The Hills Have Eyes.
Okay.
And I might say... It's certainly as a horror film, it's probably the most effective horror film out of all the horror films he did in that term, in terms of really making me uncomfortable watching it and creeping me out and scaring the hell out of me, more so than Nightmare or Scream.
Don't kill the dog. What about you, Abe?
Oh, man. Aside from the aforementioned classics of his, I'm going to be going a different direction. I think I really enjoyed People Under the Stairs, actually. I actually watched it a few times when I was younger. I think because I could relate to the young kid a bit. As I was pretty young when I was introduced to horror films. And the idea of being stuck in a creepy house with numerous booby traps, being chased around by a psychotic couple, just freaked the hell out of me. Just the idea that being trapped in that small enclosed area of all these passageways and stuff, trying to escape, and it was just really uncomfortable, but at times it was kind of also nice and cheesy. And it had a nice little blend, but that was all, that had a bit of a, it has a little bit of nostalgia attached to it.
Wes Craven had a thing about booby traps.
For Mike.
Yeah, he sure did.
The Last Out on the Left, People Under the Stairs and Nightmare on Elm Street all have booby traps.
Now, but for my favorite film besides, you know, if you take away Scream and Nightmare on Elm Street by Craven. It's probably Red Eye.
Seen that, but I don't remember much about it. I'll have to check it out again.
Yeah, it's really cool because it's basically a thriller rather than a true horror film. And it's a character drama of basically two people. And it's intense. And it's definitely a film that should not be overlooked for fans of thrillers, never mind just horror films or Wes Craven for that matter. So that would be my favorite film by him after Scream. And what about you, Eric? Besides Scream and Nightmare, what's your favorite film by Wes Craven?
I'm going to have to say the original Last House on the Left. Not really because I like the movie, but because I don't like the movie. I really find a lot of it to just be in poor taste. But because of that, it's very effective in making me uncomfortable, and I think that was the whole idea. So I think that aspect of the film is extremely successful. Plus, and from the standpoint of just being a horror genre movie, there are a couple scenes in there that are like, yeesh! Get your attention, for sure. So it's very effective in being horrific. So yeah, I'll go with the original Last House on the Left.
Nice. Yeah, it's interesting because all these films that we've mentioned, even though, you know, Wes Craven made a name for himself along with Sean Cunningham, but these films made pretty big, at least for genre fans, pretty, you know, like there's convention circuit stars. You know, the Last House on the Left had that guy Hess, who just passed away, mm-hmm. I think 2 years ago, and he had a big career after that. So, I mean, that film was the one that made him semi-famous, and he did a bunch of horror films after that. And then Hills Have Eyes, Berry Man, that made him basically a well-known genre star, and since then he's gone on and made a pretty big career for himself. Robert Englund, as we discussed, Nightmare on Elm Street, and it's interesting because these folks we would not really even know about or really care about, I guess, if it hadn't been for Wes Craven,
right?
But yeah, I mean, it's just curious how some of those folks just went off and made careers of themselves because of getting roles in Wes Craven films.
Right.
Now, what did you guys think of the reason he's had some failures? Or, Mike, as you said, 50-50 shots. What do you think was the reason for that? Wasn't he into it as much as he was when he was younger? Bad luck, money, and he didn't have enough money to make big film, or what? What do you guys think?
That's a good question. I'm gonna go with a theory here. I'm looking at this. It's a filmography on Wikipedia of his, and it's kind of a chart that shows what he directed, what he produced, what he wrote. And I would say that he usually did the best when he was both writing and directing the film. Although that's not 100%. There are some that are like, yeah, I'd never heard of. But that's my theory, that he did better when he was involved in both writing and directing as opposed to just one or the other.
Yeah. I was thinking that perhaps some of these this mixed bag of success and failure could be contributed to the changes in how people receive horror films these days, you know, that growing and always changing trend of what people are interested in seeing. Yeah, that's at least my thoughts. I mean, because some people just... You know, Halloween, for example, is a classic horror film. You know, it's considered one of the best, but I recall a friend of mine went to see a special showing of it not too long ago, in fact, somewhere. And, no one found it scary. In fact, most people were actually laughing at the film. You know, it didn't get the kind of reception it did in the past, you know. So perhaps let's see. If I'm looking at this box office chart here.
Mm-hmm.
Some of his more shocking films got a lot more attention than a few of his other ones, but that's also because those were remakes, like The Hills Have Eyes, for example, and Last House on the Left, you know, which are not only remakes of his previous work, but also very shocking films in and of themselves, regardless of which version you see.
Mm-hmm.
So I've noticed a few people go for either recently jump scare films or just the most shocking shockers or
like your torture porn, extreme horror
is probably the one I was going for. You know, those are films, the kind of films that try to push the boundaries, you know, so I'm thinking it may have to do with those, what people's tastes have grown into being lately.
Right. Well, what about you, Mike? What's your opinion on his checkered career of great films and horrible films, and then a handful in the middle?
Well, I'm looking over everything. There are a couple of things I could throw out there, and this is just spitballing. This is one. You could argue that the fact that he kind of had to learn as he went along, that he didn't seem to get a whole lot of formal training from, like, he wasn't like from the Roger Corman house or something, you know. It's
right,
you know, that may be a part of it. You know, I know some people would look down at the horror genre, could simply, you know, like it, I was like thinking, is it possible to say was he a hack who got lucky? It's like, it's hard to say when you look over his whole career, you know, which is spanning 40 years. You know, that he got lucky that many times over that biggest span of time. Somebody like Toby Hooper, who basically did Texas Chainsaw Massacre, stand so far and above everything else he did. I think it's, you know, and then you can get into the Poltergeist debate. But you could argue as to whether or not that was like a lucky shot, and then it was just sort of competent journeyman director for the other things.
Mm-hmm.
There's too many gaps for me to say. For example, you know, I haven't seen Deadly Friend. A few others that he did. Or I haven't seen others, or Cursed, or Red Eye, or My Soul to Take. But, you know, it really isn't as spotty as I thought it was. I think, you know, you have... the stuff that's not there. Things like, I'm not a fan of People Under the Stairs, but it does have its fans.
Mm-hmm.
Scream 2 and Scream 3 aren't the greatest movies in the world, but at least Scream 2 isn't awful. I think some of it may be perception. We don't like Scream 3 and Scream 2 as much because it's not Scream.
Right.
Right.
We don't like New Nightmare because it's not the original Nightmare. And we're holding up his B papers to his A papers and saying, well, it's not as good, but really they're not that bad. Something like Cursed, that's very easy to chalk up to, every director ever, you know, who's made more than a couple of films has had that one film that,
whoops.
Yeah, just everything was. And I'm looking. He directed some episodes of the mid '80s Twilight Zone revival.
I was noticing that myself.
And I haven't seen that in a long time. But like, I'm noticing one of them he did was, I think it's A Little Peace and Quiet, which is one that
that was a good one.
Yeah, and I haven't seen that in 30 years, and it still sticks out in my mind.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Is that the one where the guy ends up by himself?
No, if I remember correctly, it's the woman who gets like a watch that stops time or something like that.
Oh, right, right, right. Okay.
Yeah, that was a good one.
And so that was, so yeah, I mean, maybe he just, and it's the nature of filmmaking. You don't have control over every aspect. Some things work, some things don't. Swamp Thing, I don't think he intended to be the sort of campy thing he made it, but there's only so much you could do with 1981, or 1982 makeup effects, but and on a small budget.
Right.
Vampire in Brooklyn.
Now, Vampire in Brooklyn.
I remember enjoying that movie, but I haven't seen it in a long time.
But that's, you know, the, thunder rumbling. That's the post Silence of the Lambs, let's get big stars to do horror movies phase, right? And so we got Eddie Murphy to do a vampire film, and it probably sounded like a great idea in paper, but I have, you know, it just didn't work. But why was that? You know, sometimes things just, they just don't click, and it's hard to put a finger on it. It's not an unbelievably bad movie. It just didn't quite work on the, or at least not work on the level that they wanted it to. Really, Shocker. All right. How many of you have seen Shocker?
I have not.
I don't think I've seen either.
I heard it's mediocre, so I never bothered seeing it.
Right. Like, I saw that when it first came out in 1989 when I was in college, and I didn't like it then. But I still remember Mitch Pileggi is the villain. I remember his name, Horace Pinker. Why? It's a movie I haven't seen
since. Mitch Pileggi? Really?
Yeah.
No shit.
And well, I didn't
the same dude from the X-Files, right?
Right.
Okay.
And while it's not a film that I liked, and it was clearly an attempt to try to make another Freddy, I thought that the character is a character I hated in the way I'm supposed to hate a character, hate a villain, right? I thought the villain was really effective, even if the rest of the film didn't quite work for me. Making movies is hard, and making movies a lot of times on a low budget, which is what he was doing, is hard. And trying to repeat your own success is probably even harder. And I think when he was being original, he did better. And even like something like People Under the Stairs, I don't necessarily like the film, but I love the concept.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he's, if I was asked, like, say, was he as good a director as Carpenter? I don't think he probably was, at least not on, if you had Carpenter on his best day and if you had Craven on his best day, I think Carpenter was a better filmmaker. But, you know, I'm thinking, you know, it's really, I think I'm a kind of giving short shrift to some of the stuff that he did do. Because again, even a lot of the quote unquote misses he had have their fans. Shocker still has fans. People Under the Stairs has fans. I'm looking at it. It's really hard finding. You have places where it's thin, but you don't have a whole lot of like just absolute horrible stuff.
Now, let me ask you guys, this caught me by surprise because I had not even heard that he was sick. Did you guys know that he had cancer?
I had no idea that No, I mean, that should caught me by surprise when I heard it, like, because my mother was the one who told me that he had passed. And then when she brought up brain cancer, I was like, wait, what? Brain cancer? Seriously?
Yeah, like, I had no idea. I was like, hey, he has cancer, and by the way, it killed him. I was like, wait, what? Huh? Phil, Mike, did you guys know?
Nothing, no.
No, but you know, when something like that gets diagnosed, it can happen because it was brain cancer. That can happen real fast.
Yeah, that's true.
And my wife had a teacher that she worked with a couple of years ago who got diagnosed with brain cancer. And if I remember correctly, he had died just within a couple of weeks after it was diagnosed. Right.
Well, it can also not happen fast, though. I had an uncle that had a brain tumor and was around for another 10 years.
Yeah, and we also have to recognize that while we know that these people are celebrities, most of them don't want us to stay the hell out of their personal lives.
And that's true. That's true.
And maybe he's been popping up because of the Scream Team TV series. He's done some interviews and things like that. But maybe he didn't want, if he knew, maybe he didn't want to broadcast it to the world.
Right.
You know, and you have to respect that choice. So it could be any number of reasons, you know, but we aren't like exactly linked to his medical page on Facebook.
No, so, but I mean, it's unusual in this day and age, don't you think, that somebody of his level of celebrity suffering from something like that and it doesn't get publicized?
Eric, you know what? It happened with Michael Crichton. He just one day died of lung cancer. I was like, holy shit, I didn't even know he was sick.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it can happen, and again, I guess it depends on how the person keeps it to themselves and how they live their life privately. But again, it also could be, as Mike said, you know, he was diagnosed 3 weeks ago, and then and they said, "Oh, you only have 3 weeks to live." You know, so
yeah. And you could also argue, again, the nature of celebrity. He's a 75-year-old man who mm-hmm. hadn't made a film in a couple of years, and probably wasn't going to be hounded by the paparazzi anymore the same way he might have been 30 years ago. Meaning, in other words, the press didn't give a shit, and so if he was sick, nobody reported it, and nobody covered it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's right. Another possibility. It's unfortunate because it is a shocker, and we're used to hearing.
Shocker, no pun intended.
Yeah. You know, hearing something.
Right.
Or you know, so-and-so has been in reclusion for a while, and so you get the idea that maybe there's something up, and or it's not reclusion, it's seclusion for a while. Right. You know, they're not coming. They stopped doing conventions or whatever it may be.
I was just curious as to whether I just missed it or whether I, you know.
I don't think
I was hoping that I wasn't the only guy over here going, I didn't know he had cancer.
That's like one of the first comments on the IMDb page is on the comment section is I don't even know he was sick. And you know, it's again, a lot of you know, it's unfortunate. But once you get past 70, it's kind of hard to be shocked or surprised anymore. You know, when somebody passes,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's when Leonard Nimoy passed away earlier, you know, he was what, 90 years old.
Right, right.
Well, you know, nobody goes, well, I didn't know he was sick. Well, he was 90 years old. That's, I mean, thank God we live in a society where someone dies at 75 and we could say,
yeah,
well,
Christopher
that's a
shock. Lee is another one, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Here's a good thing. I remember back in the day when Siskel and Ebert and all those guys were doing their show every Sunday, and the thing that was cool about them is that they did, whether they were mainstream Scorsese, Spielberg, whatever, or if they were just schlock, and so, you know, they would do John Carpenter films and Craven and so forth, and they reviewed The Serpent and the Rainbow, and I remember seeing that episode way back, and they actually liked the film. Ebert gave it 3 out of 4 stars, and so while Mike was just talking, I was looking up the review, and the last in the written review by Ebert, the last paragraph is really interesting. And he goes, The Serpent in the Rainbow was directed by Wes Craven, a master of horror whose credits include The Last House on the Left, Swamp Thing, and the original A Nightmare on Elm Street. Craven will never advance in the Hollywood establishment until he embraces more respectable projects. But again, you know, respectable. I don't know if Ebert was just using that as another word for, you know, B films or genre. And yet he has such a touch for horror and the macabre. And The Serpent and the Rainbow is uncanny in the way it takes the most lurid images and makes them plausible. And this review is from 1988. So it was right after Freddy. But it was 8 years before one of the biggest Hollywood films, Scream.
Mm.
Yeah, so it was curious.
And there's nothing he said there that I would take issue with in terms of, look, it's been said time and again, it's not an original idea, that a lot of directors make horror movies until they cannot make horror movies anymore. The first chance they have to jump out of it, they will. You know, because it doesn't get the respect in Hollywood. It is a notch above porn.
Right.
Right. Some of it's changed. I mean, you know, Quentin Tarantino came out and Eli Roth and all these guys are now bringing genre into the mainstream. But go on. Like,
yeah, but Tarantino does. But how many horror films has he made? Right. I mean, you can make an argument. I mean, he starred in and co-wrote From Dusk Till Dawn, and he did half of Grindhouse. But even Grindhouse, he said in that most recent interview that, well, you know, we learned a lesson from that one, is that we can't just expect the audience to do whatever we want. And it's basically saying that I would never make that kind of movie again because nobody wanted to see it. Or, you know, the audience wasn't there for it. Right. You know, I would love to see Tarantino do a slasher film or some, you know,
that could be cool. Yeah.
A guy like Del Toro, whatever you think of him yourself, Phil, you know, he loves the genre and he wants to keep working in the genre. I always got the sense, I remember when, Music of the Heart came out, you know, that was Wes Craven basically saying to Hollywood, I can make things that are not scary. Right? That was him basically saying, this is where it was like, oh, thank God, I've been doing this for 30 years or 25 years, and I'm finally getting a chance to make a quote-unquote legitimate film. Again, and he wasn't a horror fan to begin with. I don't know where he stood on the horror genre by the end of his life.
Right.
Well,
he did that Project Greenlight with the Damon and Affleck, you know, specifically for horror, meaning he knew he was a horror director. He knew he was synonymous with the word horror.
Well, and here's the thing, is that a lot of people in Hollywood start out in horror and then get out of it later and kind of distance themselves from it. Like up until recently, Kevin Bacon did not want to talk about Friday the 13th. He did not want to acknowledge the fact that he was in that movie because he thought of it as something below the level he's at now. Well,
his reaction to Tremors as well.
Right. So where I was going with this is that I have a certain level of respect for people who start out in the genre and still respect the genre as they get further along in their careers. Like Jamie Lee Curtis, no matter what you may think about the movie H2O, she came back to do it, and she didn't have to.
And she's doing Scream Queens for Fox, I think.
Right.
Yes. So what are the networks?
So I have a certain level of respect for people who stick with the genre even after they have a level of quote-unquote success outside of it.
Right. Well, my question is, and I don't mean to cast aspersions. This is sort of almost – this could be a blanket statement, which on almost anybody that's working the horror genre, which is how much is it that they're working in the horror genre because that's the only thing people will pay them to do versus whether or not they're doing because they really love doing it. And you always have to take everything somebody says with a grain of salt when they talk about the genre they've been successful in because they don't want to piss off the fans that are putting money on their plates or food on their plates. Not, you don't usually eat money. Right. In other words, if Wes Craven said, I know I make these horror films, but I hate making the shitty movies. I was never a horror fan. I don't understand why people love watching their heads get blown off, but I'll keep showing them if they want to keep paying me to do it. And you see this, like you go to a convention or you hear interviews with actors who are like, well, I was never a horror fan before I got into it. Now, are they really now a horror fan or are they just blowing smoke because, you know, oh, I love doing that movie because that's what the fans want to hear. So I'm always a little suspicious about that. And I'm not saying Wes Craven didn't because I have no idea really what he thought about it. I know that he wasn't a fan of horror. He never watched a horror film before he made one. You know, so it's a weird perspective. Never necessarily get a chance to ask him. I'll be curious if there are any old interviews where this surfaces. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Hollywood kept throwing money at him because he was successful at it. Look, you make the most popular character to emerge from the 1980s was Freddy Krueger. Mm-hmm. And people, that'll gain you a lot of mileage. And then as that's running out of steam, you come up with Scream.
Mm-hmm.
And for God's sakes, Kevin Williamson is still making money off of Scream.
Yeah, it made his career too. Yeah.
Yep.
Hell of a writer. Yeah, you know.
Right, and you look at M. Night Shyamalan. I mean, how much mileage has he gotten just because he made Sixth Sense?
That's right.
You know, and if he'd started out with The Happening, he never would have gotten another job.
That's right.
You're correct.
Here's a good list. Since I was talking about Ebert, I went and searched for Wes Craven and his films. Reviewed by Ebert, and only reason some people say, oh, who cares, he's a critic, but Ebert, you know, generally was the great critic of our generation, and this is what he has to rate the films that of Wes Craven, and this is what it says. It says, this filmography is not intended to be a comprehensive list of the artist's work. Instead, it reflects the films Roger Ebert has reviewed, and that this person, Wes Craven, has been involved with that have been reviewed on Roger Ebert's site. And I'm very impressed that most of Ebert liked Wes Craven films. Here we go. Last House on the Left, 3.5 stars.
What?
I kid you not. 3.5 stars. Wow. Ebert gave it. And this is the same.
He got turned on when he made the girl piss herself.
and this is the same guy that trashed a bunch of other classic horror films. Yeah, The Thing and Texas Chainsaw.
The Hitcher as well.
Yeah, The Hitcher, exactly.
Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Yeah, exactly. So that was interesting that he liked House of Actually, that's his Highest review, 3.5 out of 4 stars out of any film he
not the original, right? The remake?
No, the original, 1972. Yeah. No Roger shit. Ebert gives it 3.5 stars.
What did he give Hills Have Eyes?
Well, that's what I'm going. Okay. He did not review Hills Have Eyes. At least not on his homepage. Swamp Thing, 3 out of 4 stars.
What?
Serpent and the Rainbow, 3 out of 4 stars. Wes Craven's New Nightmare, 3 out of 4 stars. Vampire in Brooklyn, 1 star. Scream.
Where are you finding this?
The RogerEbert.com, which is the Chicago.
I have it right now as well.
Scream, 3 out of 4 stars. Scream 2, Roger Ebert gives 3 out of 4 stars. Music of the Heart, Roger Ebert gives 3 out of 4 stars. Scream 3, only 2 out of 4 stars. Red Eye, 3 out of 4 stars. And Scream 4, his last Wes Craven reviewed film, 2 out of 4 stars. So only 3 films got 2 or less stars. Everything else was 3 or more out of the films that Ebert reviewed.
Wow. Last House on the Left?
I'm reading his review of Last House on the Left, and I can't believe it came from Roger Ebert.
Yeah, that's really weird. I still can't believe I was actually seeing that.
Yep. So that was pretty interesting to see that. But yeah, he liked Wes Craven, basically, based off of the review. So that's pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't, because I know he's trashed a lot of Carpenter films.
No, he was generally opposed to the horror genre as a whole.
Which is odd, because this is a guy that basically wrote a semi-horror film in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. So I never understood Ebert when it came to horror films. But generally, he liked all of Craven's films. It's kind of interesting. Yeah. How about that?
Check this out. I'm gonna just read this quote about Last House on the Left. Wes Craven's direction never lets us out from under the almost unbearable dramatic tension, except in some silly scenes involving a couple of dumb cops who overact and seriously affect the plot's credibility. The acting is unmannered and natural, I guess. There's no posturing. There's a good ear for dialogue and nuance, and there is evil in this movie. Not bloody escapism or a thrill a minute, but a fully developed sense of the vicious natures of the killers. There's no glory in this violence, and Craven has written in a young member of the gang, again borrowed on Bergman's story, who sees the horror as fully as the victims do. The movie covers the same philosophical territory as Sam Peckinpah's Straw Dogs, and is more hard-nosed about it. Sure, a man's home is his castle, but who wants to be left with nothing but a castle and a lifetime memory of horror?
Yeah, some people say that the Last House on the Left is actually a ripoff of Ingrid Bergman's film.
Actually, Wes Craven has said himself that's where he got the idea.
Oh, okay, there you go. Yeah. So, there you go.
And when you're ripping off Ingmar Bergman, it's an homage.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. All I was going to say was that it is interesting that Ebert would compare Last House on the Left to a Sam Peckinpah film rather than a trash B film. And that is funny, because that is like where the two cross, where you get the dark, gritty stuff of Peckinpah and the B crap of the Grindhouse and Drive-In. And he put this film, Last House on the Left, as an overlap of the two, which is kind of interesting how he rates it.
Yeah.
Well, let me say that one of the things you can say about Craven, clearly, we talked about him being a college professor. He's got ideas in his films that he explores. There is intelligence behind them, whatever you think of the execution, or at least in most of them, he is trying to say something. Or comment on something like People Under the Stairs, is talking about class and race in America and things like that. It's they may not always be the most insightful things, but he's saying something. So that's certainly that you could argue is critic bait, right? It's not just kill people and then kill the next person and kill the next person. And I think that thoughtfulness, even, you know, like Freddy, it's the concept of dying in your dreams and all the stuff you can do with that as a nightmarish concept. You know, and it's a nightmare. And as we get to it, spoiler warning, we discover that it's a villain you never awake from, right? You never get away from. So I think that's part of it. You know, in the end, we're 57 or so days from Halloween.
Yep.
And, on Halloween Day, they're going to have the elementary school Halloween parade in my building. And admittedly, there'll be a plethora of vomit-inducing princess costumes.
Yes.
But I promise you, mixed in among them will be no shortage of five, six, seven-year-old Freddy Kruegers and ghost faces.
Yep,
and, absolutely. You know, I don't know that you can come up with a better testament than that, is that these are things that these are kids that don't know who Wes Craven is, and they, God willing, have not seen any of his films.
I was going to say, I hope they don't know who Freddy Krueger is.
But he's become a part of, or his creations have become a part of our culture.
That's part of the reason I loved New Nightmare so much, is because it hits that right on the nose. And be like, well, what if the public perception of a fictional character is so strong that it makes it reality? That will blow your mind if you think about it long enough.
Well, and you know, what's curious too is that, you know, guy, Scroak's face and Freddy, never mind, you know, Leatherface and Michael Myers and Jason, they're, you know, teenagers and elementary schools versions of what we thought Frankenstein, the Wolfman, and Dracula are. So even if they haven't seen these movies because of their nudity and violence and profanities, they at least know of these monsters as cool monsters, similar to how we did with...
They become recognizable faces among the genre.
Exactly. Yep. So,
and, you know, you look at, okay, Nightmare on Elm Street came out in, what, 1984?
Right.
How many of the films that won Academy Awards that year do people talk about still?
Yep, that's a fair point.
I don't even know what won awards that year.
Well, you know, yeah, I'd have to look that up, certainly.
Silent Night, Deadly Night won 4 awards. It was a joke. It was a great film, though. I thought it was better than that.
Yeah, well, I'm looking,
sitting there thinking,
84.
What is he talking about?
All right, so I'm looking at this. You have films like Amadeus, The Killing Fields, A Passage to India, and, you know, these are all fine films.
Passage to India by David Lean, the same director as Lawrence of Arabia.
Starman from John Carpenter. But you don't see little kids dressing up as Starman. You don't see little kids dressing up as Mozart or Salieri.
I gotta call you out on this one. There are a bunch of films in 1984 that people still talk about, but not Academy Award winners.
Right, that's what I'm saying. There are these genre stuff that gets dismissed at the time or over.
Artie.
The arty stuff.
Artie.
And you know, this is the stuff that's remembered. It's sort of like you have, you know, Shyster and Schumer doing Superman or, Finger and Kane doing Batman. You know, these are things that will survive long beyond their life, and it may be that nobody in the end will remember who their creators are.
Actually, listen to this shit. 1984 was a good year.
Yeah.
I just looked this up. All these movies came out in 1984. Terminator, The Karate Kid, Ghostbusters, Nightmare on Elm Street, Neverending Story, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Amadeus, 16 Candles, Gremlins,
Silent Night, Deadly Night,
Revenge of the Nerds, Footloose, Spinal Tap, Romancing the Stone,
right.
Beverly Hills Cop, Red Dawn, Children of the Corn. Holy shit.
Yep.
It was a good year.
The 80s had some awesome entertainment films. Right, there really was. But
the only one of those that was an Oscar nominee was Amadeus.
Right. And the point being that which of the films that the cultural wind weather vanes, the ones that tell us these are the important movies, these are the ones that you ought to be watching, because these are the good films. And I'm not saying they're not good films. I've seen many of them. They're not the ones that endure. It's what hits the
hits pop, you know, popular consciousness and subconscious. And, you know, Craven did it. And those films, people will be watching those films every Halloween for a very, very long time.
Yep.
And it just shows you that speculative films can be better than the pretentious Oscar crapola. And I'm not saying in all cases, but for sure that year anyway, because Nightmare on Elm Street and Indiana Jones and Gremlins, and all, I mean, those are the films that I'm going to rewatch again, and I'm never going to rewatch Amadeus again, even though it was a good film. So it's just interesting how that whole thing is, Mike. Good point. Anyway, I think we should probably wrap it up, right? We're gone on for a while.
I have one more thing to bring up.
Yeah, sure.
I'm curious what you guys are thinking about the upcoming Scream TV series.
Well, it's already on.
Upcoming.
I'm just saying, has anyone actually seen it yet?
Not yet, no.
No, I'm very curious because, I mean, it's on MTV. I don't know if that would hold the show back at all. I mean, depending on how MTV is about ratings and stuff.
Don't know. Go on, Mike.
I was going to say, I'll say two things. One, I don't know if when the last time was that MTV was actually relevant.
Yeah.
I certainly can't name the last time I watched MTV.
And Mike, to be honest, I'll even say it was never relevant.
Well, culturally it was. But I didn't watch MTV when MTV was MTV.
MTV sucked.
So I don't know what it is now. I have no clue what it is. But I also know if 10 years ago, if I had told you that AMC would have the highest rated scripted drama and one of the most highly acclaimed TV series in television history, I would have found that hard to believe.
Yeah.
Right. Or HBO.
I know that
or FX or whatever.
I know that earlier tonight, Jason Lloyd posted on one of his groups an article that he agrees with about Scream the TV series. So if you want to know what Phil's going to think, you could go read that.
I don't get your point. All right, I'll have to check.
He's saying that you agree with Jason Lloyd quite a bit.
Ah, I get you. Okay. Watch this. Yes. Jason Lloyd of Horrorphilia.com and My Bloody Podcast.
Yeah, he actually posted that on My Bloody Podcast.
Ah, okay. That was a Facebook group, yeah. One other thing I wanted to mention was, do you think part of Craven's slacking, or even though he still had some good films after that, but the sequels, do you think he gets sucked into sequel after sequel, you know, money, 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 and this is all you could do?
I think he was reluctantly involved in most of those sequels.
Except for Scream. I'm not just talking about Nightmare, but Scream, too.
Nightmare, he said that he didn't think there were going to be sequels. And, you know, more the fool he. And he basically just kind of gave his blessing to the films. I don't think he would have, you know, Nightmare eventually, you know, died a terrible death with Freddy's Dead.
Yeah.
And you could argue cynically that he brought the franchise back because it, you know, that was probably his money baby, right?
Well, the last thing he was involved with before New Nightmare was Part 3.
Part 3 was awesome.
And then everything, his name is not on anything until New Nightmare. So he probably did
for a lot of those.
Well, yes, I'm sure he did as the creator of the character. But I'm willing to bet that one of his motivations behind coming back to do New Nightmare was to put his baby to bed himself.
Well, I think the fact that if he had just made another Nightmare on Elm Street movie,
mm-hmm.
then I could say he was doing it for the money. The fact what he came up with with a new Nightmare, which is a good film. I don't think it's a great film. It's a good film, but it's a great concept. And it's a fun concept. He didn't have to go there. He didn't have to put that much work and effort into it. He could have said, you know, get me, Joe Hack to write a script, Freddy killing people, I'll direct it, and just put the money back the truck up to my bank.
Right.
Now, by the time he got to Scream, I mean, that made a shit ton of money. I don't know if that's the reason why he did it, or if he just was enamored with the concept, because it is films commenting on films.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them do. And again, they all had something to say. I don't think the third one said it very well. You know, and but there's a twinkle to the Scream films, right? A horror film that comments on a horror film, a horror sequel that comments on sequels.
Yep.
You know, and then the new one, which is, you know, sort of commenting on horror then versus now. You know, it's there's stuff there. I don't think I would ever say that he sold out with the sequels.
No, that's fair. That's fair. I was just curious if maybe he just gets stuck in that thing, in your guys' opinion of it. I pretty much agree with you, Mike. So, you know, partly, but you know, there was still stuff there.
But it could be, Wes, we need you to do Scream 3. I want to make Red Eye. You're going to do Scream 3. Can I make Red Eye, or can I make Cursed, or whatever it is? It could be part of those things.
Yeah,
exactly. That's how he gets into it. You know, yeah. And that's part of, you know what, that's part of the business.
Yep,
and the fact is, right. I don't think I'll give this him credit in this. I don't think I ever saw a film from him that I thought he was phoning it in.
Right.
The films that I think were a miss, I thought were earnest misses. You know, he was trying something. I don't think it worked for me, but it was. And we've seen like lazy filmmaking, and I don't think I could ever say I saw him make a lazy film.
Yep. No, I would agree with that. That's fair. So, all right. So, what? Either way, what? No matter what folks' thoughts are, he has four films, two classics, iconic, and two classics, at least in the horror genre, and then a number of good films with a handful of stinkers. But again, this is every director's like that, even Steven Spielberg. It's just that he worked in the genre to basically his whole career. And so a little different, but all in all, generally the same as most directors. A lot of good films, some great, and a couple of stinkers. But he will be remembered because he made some iconic films that will never be forgotten. And as Mike you said, the kids are still going to wear those costumes of some of the monsters that he created. So, all right, final thoughts. Eric, why don't you begin, my friend?
Well, I was shocked and saddened to hear of his passing. He was a titan in the horror genre. He created one of the most iconic horror villains of all time in Freddy Krueger. I'm sad that he's gone, and I hope he didn't suffer too much.
Yep. My opinion is, yeah, I was shocked. It was surprising, similar to how when Michael Crichton passed away, I was like, say what? You know, and it was like, wow. I mean, a total surprise. Very unfortunate. It appeared that he had some things on his plate, obviously. Executive producer roles for sure, including the MTV series that you mentioned, Abe. But generally, I thought he still was someone that was relevant, and wouldn't have been surprised if he had done a couple more films, no matter being mid-70s. But he will be missed, and it is unfortunate of his passing. And so, yeah, it's too bad. What about you, Abe?
Yeah, the horror community took a major blow with his passing, and it is sad. But he did leave us quite a few great films that pretty much etched his name into both our memories and our nightmares. And I think we couldn't ask for, you know, a greater name amongst horror directors and producers. And he will be missed. But as I said, you should definitely he left us some great movies, and you should check them all out.
Yeah, absolutely. And Scream Factory's released a number of them already. Swamp Thing, Serpent and the Rainbow. I think Shocker's coming.
Shocker came out recently, or is coming out.
Yeah. So, Mike, what don't you? Yes,
People Under the Stairs also, I think, is a Shout
Factory. That's right. It is.
That
it
came
is.
Out recently.
Yep.
You know what? I'm really glad we did this podcast.
Thank you, Eric. It was your idea.
Oh, yeah. No problem.
I'm sorry I've been so busy with this first week of school for me. I haven't been able to rewatch anything of his. I was like tempted to put on Red Eye, just haven't had time.
But I'm glad we did this because it's really memory is a shitty thing sometimes, especially as we get older. And, you know, I was probably my first impressions on Wes Craven was probably short selling him because things that I thought I didn't necessarily like People Under the Stairs, may have magnified in my memory more than they should have been. And, you know, I'm glad we revisited it. And I think, you know, he's probably better than I was really ever giving him credit for. You know, the guy is a horror icon for a reason. He has done stuff that most of us could only hope to do one day in terms of contributing to the genre. Or, you know, just creating things that will live on past our lives. And, you know, we don't remember who created Robin Hood, you know, but Robin Hood's still with us. And most artists, you know, would be happy just knowing that their work survives, even if their name is no longer associated with it. And I have a feeling, you know, that you could very well end up with something like that with characters like, with Freddy Krueger.
Yeah, absolutely. And never mind Ghostface for the fact that MTV's made a series out of it.
Yep.
So well said, and very well. So Wes Craven, hopefully we gave some insight or just entertained you folks, because again, like Mike said, we were very thorough or anything like that. It was more
it was pretty quickly decided. I mean, it's a Thursday night right now, and he passed on, what was it, Sunday?
Yeah, Sunday.
So I mean, I just threw it out there. Do you guys want to do a Wes Craven thing? Because it just seemed like the thing to do, and we're all very busy and didn't have a whole lot of time to plan it. But it seemed appropriate, so I'm glad we did it.
And I sat down not knowing which topic we were going with tonight. So
I was like you, Mike. I had no time at all. I was away for a week last week, out of the country, and. So, I mean, I had no idea what to watch or how to watch it or even fit it in, specifically for the fact that I had to catch up on work and home stuff anyway. So I went in blind, just as you did. But I think we still did a pretty good job. Wes Craven will be missed.
I hope he has a restful slumber.
Fair enough. All right. So with that stated, next week, we have our 200th anniversary episode, so folks, send in your emails and voicemails.
Sorry, Phil, I can't let you get away with that one. Anniversary actually means an annual event. We have not been doing this for 200 years. It's our 200th episode.
That's right. So 200th episode.
Well, time is a relative thing.
True. But either way, we do have at least one voicemail and one email already to play for that episode. And we got a special topic. We do what I think, Mike, that you came up with. It was tentpole films. We're doing a big film next week, and then we'll go back into
our... We're doing Wes Craven's pornography filmography. That's what we're doing.
That's right. So anyway...
There are a lot of tentpoles in those movies.
So folks, hopefully you'll get emails or voicemails in, but either way, we'll catch you next week. So Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning us to listen to us look back on the works of Wes Craven tonight. Unfortunately, he won't be around to create anything else for us. So make sure to go back and give his classics a visit sometime soon. Come back next week for our 200th episode. We think you'll like it.